Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the psychology world is anxiously awaiting, well, maybe not anxiously, that's a disorder. There's this new psychiatric catalog coming out that's going to make a lot of people have tantrums. No, the catalog calls too many tantrums disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Okay, the new edition of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, or DSM-5, is due out later this month, and people are grieving the old categories, which did not include grief as a mental illness. The new one does. There I said grief, now certifiable for some folks. And it used to include Asperger's, which now may be folded into autism. So you get the idea, a major reclassification of our minds by the American Psychiatric Association, which has vast implications for who gets diagnosed, who gets labeled, who gets treated, and who gets covered for that treatment. And it's really controversial. My next guest has spent the last 2 years following the development of the DSM-5, and even before its release, is out with a book of his own that questions the methods and the judgment and even the integrity of the people making the DSM-5. He even questions whether science can actually categorize mental illness at all. Gary Greenberg is a practicing psychotherapist in Connecticut, has previously written Manufacturing Depression, you know that book, and The Noble Lie. His new book is The Book of Woe, The DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Thanks very much for coming on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. It's good to be back.
So I know we're anticipating lots of controversial changes in the DSM-5 when it's released in a few weeks. So why didn't you wait to finish the book until it's actually out?
Well, the obvious answer to that question is commercial considerations. It was important for my publisher and for me to have the book out at the time that the DSM came out. More to the point, though, the DSM sort of went dark back last fall, so there hasn't really been any more information forthcoming. So the book was written and finished at the time that the last bits of information were available, except for the very particular textual changes that might be made.
And listeners, maybe you've been hearing about some of the anticipated changes in the DSM-5, which comes out later this month. We can take your phone calls for Gary Greenberg, 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Maybe others who practice in the world of psychology or psychiatry or social work, or anyone, 212-433-9692. Maybe this affects you as a client or a patient or just a fellow human being, 212-433-9692. And let me jump right through some of the specific changes that you raise questions about in the book. Then we'll get to the bigger question of whether psychiatry can be seen as a science at all. I mentioned grief, a normal part of human emotion, obviously, after we suffer a major loss. What are you expecting that's different about grief in the DSM-5?
Well, when the DSM, the modern DSM, which was originated in 1980 with the DSM-3, came out, it became clear that, in fact, it was known before it came out, that most everybody who's grieving the loss of a loved one will qualify for the depression diagnosis. And on the face of it, that just doesn't make sense to call somebody who's in mourning sick. So an exception was carved out of the diagnosis saying that if you meet all the criteria, but you're still, but you're within a certain period of a loss, then you can't be diagnosed with major depression. And this clause, this codicil, has been eliminated with the DSM-5, largely because it's pretty clear that there's no reason to accept bereaved people and not recently unemployed, recently foreclosed, recently divorced, anybody who's had a catastrophe. And the choice was really between acknowledging that in all those cases, and maybe more, the depression that those people were experiencing wasn't the same as the depression somebody else might be experiencing. You could do that, or you could just say all depression is depression, and that's what they chose to do. So now, if you have the symptoms of depression, that is, if you've been grieving for 2 weeks, you can be diagnosed.
And is this bad? What if you're grieving for 2 weeks and you want some kind of help, be it counseling or medical help or drugs?
Exactly. I think that's a really important point. While I write a lot about how this depression, this decision was made, I'm not sure that it's all that important, except at a symbolic level. It symbolizes the way that the DSM is a confusing document, and it's the psychiatrists who make it are confused about just how to go about making diagnoses and what the effects of their diagnoses are on the people who get diagnosed. But is it going to change treatment? No. Look, if you go to a psychiatrist or your family doc or a social worker and you're recently bereaved and you're really upset, I should hope they're going to give you something. They're going to help you. They're going to listen to you. And if it seems necessary, treat you. But let's remember, you don't need to be diagnosed with major depression to get any of those services. You can 72% of antidepressant medications prescriptions are written in the absence of a psychiatric diagnosis.
So your complaint with a lot of these things is that the treatment remains the same and maybe should remain the same, but the labeling changes, so more people will get a label of mentally ill. Is that just kind of a bookkeeping change that doesn't really matter in the scheme of things, or does it have consequences?
Well, it does matter in the scheme of things in some ways. It matters in terms of how people understand themselves. So right by now, it's become fairly commonplace to refer to yourself or your friends as, you know, I have OCD or I have depression or something like that. And ultimately, what happens is over the long run, people, regardless of the statistics of how many people are actually diagnosed, people come to self-diagnose. They come to see themselves as psychiatrically disordered when they're having experiences that previously weren't considered psychiatric disorders. And that changes the way people live their lives. It changes what people expect of their lives and of each other.
And I guess that would apply to some of the other examples that I pulled. Binge eating disorder. Now, we already thought binging and purging and stuff like that related to anorexia, which was already labeled. Another one, mild cognitive impairment. Mild cognitive impairment sounds straightforward, but just, I guess, at a lower level of having trouble. And for some tantrum-prone, irritable children, a new label called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. So are all of these kind of new labels for things we already knew about and already get treated?
I think that's one way to put it. There are reasons, bureaucratic and otherwise, for having created those diagnoses, and each one of them is fairly complex, and I'm not going to tangle you in the weeds about that. But I will tell you that in the case of disruptive mood dysregulation disorder, it was acknowledged by the committee that made up that disorder that most of the children who qualified for it already qualified for a disorder called oppositional defiant disorder. And the reason that they decided to give them a new diagnostic home was because ODD, the oppositional defiant disorder, has a bad reputation. This was in the words of the guy who ran the committee that decided this. It has a bad reputation among insurers, among doctors, among parents, among teachers. And so the idea was to give these kids a sort of a fresh start, a new diagnostic home. It was also an attempt to solve a different diagnostic problem, which is that over the last 15 years, many children have been getting diagnosed with bipolar disorder and placed on antipsychotic drugs. Even though the bipolar disorder diagnosis doesn't really fit them. The problem is that you have all these kids who are severely irritable and difficult to handle, and they need services, and the best way to secure those services turns out to be to create a new diagnosis for them.
My guest is Connecticut psychotherapist Gary Greenberg, and with the new DSM-5, the Handbook of Mental Illnesses and Psychiatric Disorders, coming out this month from the American Psychiatric Association. He has written The Book of Woe, The DSM, and The Unmaking of Psychiatry. Are you surprised that all our lines are full?
No, and I've got on my bulletproof vest, so we're all set.
And luckily you're on the phone, and they're not coming to you in person anyway. So Ann and Lynbrook, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ann.
Hi, how are you? I don't know if this has so much to do with depression, but alcoholics tend to be depressed at the beginning of their recovery. And I heard rumblings that they were going to disregard the fact that it is a disease and unlabel that. Is that true?
Do you know?
Well, it's not that simple. The substance abuse and substance dependence categories are being removed from the DSM in favor of something called a substance use disorder. So doctors will no longer have to distinguish between addiction and mere abuse. They can simply say a person has a problem with a substance and rate it for its severity. It's one of those changes that sounds, in my opinion, a lot worse than it is, but it does have a side effect, which is that because they relax the criteria, it will probably catch more people in the diagnostic net than previously were caught in the diagnostic net.
Virginia and Darianne, you're on WNYC. Hi, Virginia.
Hi. My question has to do with anorexia and bulimia. My daughter was diagnosed with anorexia a few years ago, and she has relapsed several times. And I'm convinced that it's because insurance companies have taken her out of treatment too early because they categorize anorexia based on weight. And I can get my daughter to eat, and I can get her to get back up to weight, but I can't make her get better psychologically. And so I'm wondering if this new regulation will recategorize eating disorders in any way.
As far as I know, anorexia, the weight standard won't change. And this is a good example of, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. The whole point of these diagnoses, well, not the whole point, but a major point is to gain legitimacy in the eyes of the insurance companies that pay for treatment. But in order to do that, you have to have standards, and one of those standards is a percentage of weight loss that characterizes anorexia, and if you get back over that threshold, well, by that logic, you're no longer sick. Nobody who works in the field really believes that. But there have to be thresholds, otherwise the scheme doesn't really work.
Virginia, thank you. But on that point, if you're worried about overdiagnosis in general, people with emotional or mental health issues are always fighting with insurance companies for more inclusive coverage. So maybe it's a good thing if categories are becoming more expansive and more varied, because more people seeking your services as a psychotherapist or some other legitimate treatment will be able to afford it. Maybe it solves bigger problems than it creates. Is that possible?
Well, I think if you start with the assumption that the only way to pay for psychotherapy is through health insurance, then indeed you're correct, or at least you're on the right trail, and that's why the DSM has so many categories in it. Explicitly, the modern DSM was designed to cover as many possible problems as it could.
Well, besides health insurance and out-of-pocket, what else are you recommending?
That's it. Health insurance and out-of-pocket. Or to put it another way, people who do what I do might have to make less money. The DSM, it's a really cynical thing. And I'm not the only one who feels this way. A former president of the American Psychiatric Association told me the reason he uses the DSM is not about treatment, it's not about diagnosis, it's about getting paid. And the DSM is the key to the treasure chest. If you don't want to participate in if you don't want that treasure, you don't have to use the DSM, you don't have to pathologize your clients, and you don't have to act in bad faith. My personal feeling is that an awful lot of the problems of the DSM could be solved if mental health clinicians didn't use it and therefore made less money.
And I guess you're concerned about conflict of interest, that many of these new categories were conceived and promoted by advocates for people with mental illness with ties to the pharmaceutical industry, which obviously has an interest. How impure are you accusing this process of being?
I don't think that it's corrupt in the sense that, you know, some doc somewhere gets paid by an insurance by a pharmaceutical company to introduce a PET diagnosis into the DSM. Nobody's that competent anyway. But I think there's a kind of intellectual corruption at work here. All of the people who make the DSM start from the place that says that mental suffering is a medical disorder, and increasingly what that means is that it's a brain disorder. Now, nobody knows if that's true. Certainly, we're in the infancy of understanding how the brain affects experience, consciousness, behavior, and so on. So I don't think that it's necessarily the case that it doesn't have to be this way, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Dawn on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, Brian. Quick question. In conjunction with the DSM compared to other nations' criteria, I believe within the international community they use the WHO standards. So my question is, how can we use, because the DSM is not very effective, unfortunately it is what it is, but
Dawn, do you work in the field, just for clarification?
Yes, I'm actually a psychiatric nurse practitioner student, so I'm in the process of learning DSM-4 at the moment, but next semester I'll be learning DSM-5.
I think you will.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's going to play
And so
a
your
role.
Question is whether there are alternative classifications that people use,
yes.
something other than the DSM?
Yes.
The answer to that is that there is an international classification of diseases that includes psychiatric disorders issued by the World Health Organization. It's called the ICD. And it isn't all that much different from the DSM. In fact, there's a great effort to coordinate the two documents. One of the biggest differences between the two is that the ICD is free. And the DSM costs a couple hundred dollars. In fact, the codes that are in the DSM, the numbers that are used to code bills for insurers and so on, are ICD codes. They're not DSM codes. So a clinician can use the ICD to do what he does or she does with the DSM.
But, Dawn, I think you're raising a whole other set of issues because we've been talking about overclassifying people and the flow of money. Are you saying the DSM is actually not that effective for helping people?
Well, there's really no it's like, unfortunately, psychiatry, there's no clinical laboratory work. We go with our assessments. We look at a person through an observation, so we have to base it on what we present. Unfortunately, in other fields of medicine, you have lab tests to determine, oh, this person has hep C or this person has anemia.
Right. So, Dawn, I'm going to leave it there. And as we start to run out of time, Gary Greenberg, this brings us to, in a way, the largest and maybe most controversial argument in your book, which is that you're not simply concerned with the best possible categorization of mental or emotional conditions. You go all the way to question whether psychology or psychiatry are science at all.
I would qualify that a little bit. Science is nothing but a rigorous way of obtaining knowledge.
Right.
Anything can be scientific. But psychiatry, what it isn't, at least for the most part, it's not medical science. Medical science, as Dawn just said, is we expect anyway that there are going to be objective findings to validate our impressions and the signs and symptoms that we see. Now, not all of regular medicine has those, so let's say for a moment that medical science in some ways isn't up to its own standards. But psychiatry doesn't have a single disorder with lab or with what we expect from medicine, that is, objective measures. And that is a problem. It's a problem that everybody in psychiatry knows about. It's the problem they've been struggling with since the beginning because it makes everybody, including psychiatrists, question whether or not they really belong in the medical realm. And the answer to that question is, at this point, no. The solution may not be to make psychiatry more medical. The solution may be to expand the way that we think about suffering in general. But for the moment, psychiatry is operating on an assumption, which is that mental suffering can be reduced to brain disorder. And we don't know the brain well enough to understand that and to say that for sure. And we don't know what to do with it, even if we do know it at this point.
And just one political question, because among the political actors in your book is the Occupy movement. And you write that a little bit of chaos broke out at the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting in 2011 when Occupy the APA showed up. And it occurred to me, wow, that's so different from an earlier radical movement, ACT UP, which joined forces with the pharmaceutical industry in the 80s to make sure more drugs for AIDS were readily available. So what is it, in our last 30 seconds, that the Occupy movement wants here?
Well, they're very sensitive to issues of power. And what they see there is that the same thing the ACT UP people were after, only they wanted psychiatrists to use their power or doctors to use their power in their favor. Here what people are saying is, wait a minute, you're asserting all of this authority over our minds, and what is it based on? And what does it cause? It's causing all of these side effects. It's causing a populace with 15% or so of us are on psychiatric drugs with unknown side effects whose main effects nobody really understands that don't often work. And they're saying, you know, in the same way that financiers exert control over our material lives, you guys are trying to exert control over the lives of our minds. Now, that may sound really paranoid and conspiratorial and all that, and sometimes it is excessive, but there's a lot of truth to that. The problem with the DSM is that it asserts an authority over inner life that it simply doesn't deserve from the evidence.
Gary Greenberg, psychotherapist practicing, where in Connecticut, by the way?
My practice is in New London.
And the author now of the Book of Woe, the DSM and the Unmaking of Psychiatry. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure.
And coming up next, video blogger Francesca Ramsey with her top rules for social media etiquette, and we'll collect some of yours. Stay with us.